It's pretty eye-opening. You know, over half of us working folks in the US, we might be facing a retirement where we can't keep up our current living standards. Potentially even close to the federal poverty level. Yikes. That's a real wake-up call to start seriously thinking about how we're preparing.
It is. And you know, that's exactly what we're here to help you with today. We're going deep into this whole retirement plan thing using this pretty comprehensive resource we've got here, Life Chapter 11 Retirement Plans, to really give you a solid understanding of the options out there.
Yeah, because let's face it, retirement savings can feel like a jumble of 401k, IRAs, all these acronyms. Our goal is to like cut through all that noise so you can come away feeling informed and not totally lost.
Right. And to kick things off, we're going to zero in on the two main ways most people save for retirement. Individual retirement accounts, those are IRAs, and then the plans you get through your job, employer-sponsored qualified plans. These are like the foundational pieces for a secure future.
Okay, so let's dive right into IRAs, individual retirement accounts. First off, who can actually open one of these things?
So the main requirements boil down to two things. You got to be under 70 and a half years old, and you need what they call earned income.
Earned income. Okay, we all kind of know what that means, but can you give us the nitty-gritty?
Sure. Think about your regular paycheck, your salary, wages, commissions, bonuses, even tips all count. Now, what's interesting is if you get money as part of a divorce settlement, that counts too. But what doesn't qualify as earned income is passive income. So stuff like rent, you're collecting interest or dividends from investments and payments from pensions or annuities. So that's income, but it doesn't make you eligible to contribute to an IRA.
Gotcha. So it's all about income from working. Now, how much can you actually put into an IRA each year? Is there a
Yes,
limit?
absolutely. There are annual contribution limits, and it all boils down to which is lower, 100% of your earned income for the year, or a specific dollar amount that the government sets. And they can actually change that dollar amount every year to keep pace with, you know, inflation, cost of living, and all that.
So is that same dollar limit if it's your own IRA or if you're contributing to a spousal IRA?
Exactly. A spousal IRA is for a spouse who might not have their own earned income. The same annual limit applies to that as well. And then for those of us 50 and over, there's this helpful thing called a catch-up provision, where you can put in an extra amount each year on top of the regular limit. It's a way to, you know, catch up a little bit.
Yeah, that catch-up provision can be a lifesaver.
Right.
Now, a big draw for retirement accounts is the tax advantages.
Right.
So, with a traditional IRA, can you always deduct your contributions from your taxable income?
Well, it's not always a slam dunk.
Okay.
The ability to deduct those contributions depends on whether you or your spouse are covered by a retirement plan at work and also on your HEI, that's adjusted gross income.
All right, so let's break down those different scenarios.
Okay, so there are basically three main situations. First, if neither you nor your spouse has a retirement plan at work, generally you can deduct the full amount of your IRA contributions on your federal income tax return. Second, if one or both of you do have an employer-sponsored plan, then whether you can deduct depends on your AGI. There's this income range, and it changes every year where you can still fully deduct the contribution. If your income is a bit higher, you might only be able to deduct a part of it. And lastly, if your income is above that upper limit, you can't deduct any of your traditional IRA contributions.
It sounds like a bit of a maze.
It can be a little tricky.
So even if you can't deduct your contributions, can you still put money into a traditional IRA?
Yes, absolutely. It's really important to know that you can always make the full annual contribution to a traditional IRA, whether or not you can deduct it on your taxes.
Okay.
So even if you don't get that immediate tax break, your money is still growing tax deferred inside that IRA.
That's a good point. So where can you actually put your IRA funds? Are there any restrictions on what you can invest in?
Definitely. There are rules about what you can and can't hold in an IRA.
Okay.
So on the not allowed list are things like life insurance policies and collectibles like artwork, antiques, stamp collections, coin collections. You also generally can't invest in hard assets like precious gems or bullion forms of precious metals, with one exception. You can hold U.S. minted gold and silver coins in an IRA.
So no building that rare comic book collection with your IRA funds. Got it. What is allowed then?
You've got a good range of choices. Allowed investments include flexible premium annuities, different types of bank accounts, brokerage accounts. Those let you invest in stocks, bonds, ETFs, and then mutual funds.
All right, so the usual suspects are there. So the money's in the IRA, it's growing tax deferred. What happens if you need to tap into it before retirement age, like before you hit 59 and a half?
That's where we get into premature withdrawals. So generally, if you take money out of a traditional IRA before you're 59 and a half, you'll get hit with a 10% penalty tax on top of the regular income tax you owe on that withdrawal. But There are some big exceptions to this penalty.
Oh, exceptions. Always good to hear about. What are some of the main ones?
Well, you can avoid the penalty if you're taking distributions as like a series of equal periodic payments based on your life expectancy, or if you have some big unreimbursed medical expenses exceeding a certain percentage of your AGI, or if you're using the money for health insurance premiums while you're unemployed. There are also exceptions for certain higher education expenses and for a down payment on a first-time home purchase up to a lifetime limit of $10,000.
That first-time home buyer exception, that's a big one for a lot of folks.
It is.
What else would let you avoid the penalty?
Distributions made to an ex-spouse or a dependent child as part of a divorce decree are also penalty-free. And if you accidentally over-contribute to your IRA and then take out that excess to fix it, that withdrawal won't be penalized either.
Okay, so those are some important situations to keep in mind. Now, what if you want to move your IRA money from one financial institution to another? What's the deal with that?
You've got two main ways to move IRA funds, rollovers, and direct transfers. With a rollover, the money is actually distributed to you, and then you have a limited time to put it into a new IRA. With a direct transfer, the funds go straight from the old IRA provider to the new one without you ever actually touching the money.
So a direct transfer seems much simpler. Are there any downsides to rollovers we should know about?
Yeah, there are a couple of important things. First, with a rollover, you usually only have 60 days from when you receive the distribution to deposit it into that new IRA. If you miss that 60-day deadline, the money becomes taxable, and if you're under 59.5 and no exception applies, you could be hit with that 10% penalty tax too. Second, if you're rolling over money from a 401k or other employer-sponsored plan into an IRA, your employer is required to withhold 20% of the amount for federal income taxes.
Wow, 20%, that's a big chunk.
Yeah.
Can you give us an example of how that works?
Sure, let's say you're rolling over $100,000 from your old 401k. You'll probably only get $80,000 at first, with the other $20,000 going straight to the IRS. Now, to avoid taxes and penalties, you'd really want to come up with that extra $20,000 and deposit the full $100,000 into your new IRA within that 60-day window. If you only put in the $80,000 you actually received, that missing $20,000 is considered a taxable distribution and, again, potentially subject to that early withdrawal penalty.
Okay.
You would get credit for that $20,000 withholding when you file your taxes,
okay,
assuming you did deposit the full amount.
That's super important to know, so you don't end up with a nasty surprise come tax time. Are there any other rules about rollovers?
Yeah, there's something called the once per 12-month rule. You can generally only roll over money from one IRA to another once every 12 months, but this rule doesn't apply to direct transfers, so you can do those as often as you need.
Gotcha. That clears up moving money between IRAs.
Yeah.
Now, as you get closer to retirement, there's this thing called required minimum distributions, or RMDs. What's the lowdown on those?
RMDs are the minimum amounts you have to start taking out of your traditional IRA and other qualified retirement accounts once you reach a certain age. Thanks to the Secure Act 2.0, the age for starting RMDs has changed a bit. For folks who turn 72 after December 31st, 2022, and turn 73 before January 1st, 2023, the age to start taking RMDs is now 73.
And what happens if you just don't take your RMD?
The penalties can be pretty hefty. If you don't withdraw the required amount, you could get hit with a 25% excise tax penalty on the amount you should have taken out. But there's a way to potentially reduce that. If you do take the required distribution and file an amended tax return reflecting that the penalty goes down to 10%, you usually have 2 years after the end of the tax year the RMD was missed to fix it.
Okay, definitely something to keep on the radar as you approach retirement.
Oh.
So we talked about contributions being tax deductible, maybe. How are the actual withdrawals taxed once you're retired?
Well, generally, any contributions you made to a traditional IRA that you deducted from your taxes, along with any earnings from your investments, they're all taxed as ordinary income when you withdraw them in retirement. But if you made any contributions to your IRA that you didn't deduct, those come out tax-free.
Okay, that makes sense. What happens to your IRA when you pass away?
Right.
How are those assets handled for your beneficiaries?
The rules for distributions after death depend on who the beneficiary is. If it's your spouse, they have a great option. They can treat the IRA as their own, basically becoming the new owner.
Okay.
And this transfer to a spouse is tax-free. Other beneficiaries, like children or other family members, have a few options. They could take a lump sum distribution or spread the assets out over no more than 5 years after your death. Or they could take distributions over their own lifetime or over your remaining life expectancy, if that's longer. It's also key to remember the entire IRA value is part of your estate for estate tax purposes.
So that's important for estate planning, for sure.
Yeah.
Because we spent a good chunk of time on traditional IRAs. Now let's talk about their cousin, the Roth IRA. What's the fundamental difference there?
The main difference with a Roth IRA is in how it's taxed. Unlike traditional IRAs, your contributions to a Roth are never tax deductible. But the big win comes later if you meet certain conditions, your qualified distributions in retirement are completely tax-free.
Tax-free withdrawals in retirement sounds pretty awesome.
It does.
What makes a Roth IRA distribution qualified?
There are two main things. First, the Roth IRA has to have been open for at least 5 tax years.
Okay.
And second, the distribution has to be taken after you turn 59 and a half, or it has to be because of death, disability, or to help with a first-time home purchase up to that $10,000 lifetime limit we talked about with traditional IRAs.
So no upfront tax break, but the payoff later can be huge. Are there any other big differences between Roth and traditional IRAs?
Yep. A couple Roth IRAs don't have required minimum distributions during your lifetime, which gives you more flexibility in planning. And you can keep contributing to a Roth IRA no matter how old you are, as long as you have earned income and your income isn't too high. Speaking of income, there are income limits that can prevent people with higher incomes from contributing directly to a Roth IRA.
Gotcha. So there are income restrictions. Can you have both a Roth and a traditional IRA at the same time?
Yes, you can. But the total you contribute to all your IRAs, both traditional and Roth, in a single year can't be more than the annual limit for one IRA. So it's a combined limit across all your IRA accounts.
Okay, that gives us a really good rundown of IRAs. Now let's switch gears to the other big category, employer-sponsored qualified plans. What are the general tax advantages these offer?
Employer-sponsored plans come with some nice tax perks.
Okay.
First, any contributions your employer makes to the plan are tax-deductible for their business. Second, the money you put in from your paycheck is also usually tax-deductible, which lowers your current taxable income. Third, neither your contributions nor your employer's are considered taxable income to you right now.
Okay.
And finally, any earnings within the plan, except for Roth features and a 401k, grow tax-deferred until you withdraw them in retirement.
So they're pretty sweet deal tax-wise.
Mm.
How are the distributions from these plans taxed in retirement?
Well, generally, distributions from these plans, again, except for Roth account balances, are fully taxed as ordinary income in retirement because they come from those pre-tax contributions and tax-deferred earnings.
Okay.
The rules about taking money out before 59 and a half, including that 10% penalty and its exceptions, are pretty much the same as for traditional IRAs. And just like traditional IRAs, these plans have RMD rules that usually start around the same age, although you might be able to delay your first payment until April 1st of the year after you reach that age.
Now, these are qualified plans. What does that actually mean? What makes them qualified?
To be considered qualified and get those great tax benefits, the plans have to be approved by the IRS, and they're generally governed by ERISA. That's the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. ERISA lays out a bunch of important requirements.
Like what are the key things these plans need to do?
Okay, first off, there are rules about who can participate. The plan has to be available to most of the company's regular employees, not just a select few. Typically, any employee who's 21 or older and has worked there for at least a year has to be eligible to participate. Second, there are non-discrimination rules. The plan can't give much better benefits to highly compensated employees and executives compared to other employees. And it can't discriminate based on gender either.
That makes sense. It's about making sure everyone gets a fair shot. What else is covered by ERISA?
Vesting is another crucial part. Vesting determines when you actually fully own the money in your retirement account. You're always 100% immediately vested in your own contributions. But employer contributions, like matching funds, usually have a vesting schedule. Under ERISA, you have to become 100% vested in those employer contributions after no more than 6 years of service.
So you might have to stick around for a bit to fully own their contributions. What other requirements are there for these qualified plans?
There are big reporting and disclosure requirements. Participants need to get a written summary of the plan when they first become eligible. They need to know about any big changes to the plan. And they get an annual report with the plan's performance and financial status. Then there are fiduciary responsibilities. Anyone who has control over managing the plan or its assets is considered a fiduciary. They have a legal duty to act in the best interests of the plan participants and beneficiaries following what's called the prudent person rule.
Those fiduciary responsibilities sound really important to protect employees' retirement savings. Now, there are all sorts of different employer-sponsored qualified plans out there. Can we get a quick overview of the most common ones?
Absolutely. Let's start with pension plans. They come in two main flavors, defined benefit or defined contribution. A defined benefit plan promises you a specific retirement benefit based on things like your salary history and how long you've worked there. You might get this as a lump sum or regular monthly payments, an annuity. A defined contribution pension plan doesn't guarantee a specific payout. Instead, it says how much the employer and sometimes you as the employee will contribute to your account.
Gotcha.
A key thing about all pension plans is that the employer is legally required to make regular funding contributions.
So defined benefit is the more traditional pension with a set payout, and defined contribution is more about the contributions made over time. What other types are out there?
Next up are profit sharing plans. These are defined contribution plans, but unlike pension plans, the employer doesn't have to contribute every year. The amount and timing of their contributions are usually up to them and often depend on the company's profits. There's a limit on how much an employer can contribute to these plans, usually capped at 25% of the total payroll for all the participating employees.
Then there are KEO plans, sometimes called HR 10 plans. Who are those for?
KEO plans are specifically for self-employed people and owners of unincorporated businesses, like sole proprietorships and partnerships. They can be set up as either defined benefit or defined contribution plans, similar to the pension plans offered by big corporations.
And what about the super popular 401k plan?
Right. 401k plans let employees contribute some of their pre-tax salary, which lowers their current taxable income. And a big perk for a lot of people is that employers often match a portion of those contributions, which is essentially free money towards your retirement.
Yeah.
401k plans usually have higher annual contribution limits compared to traditional IRAs.
We also hear a lot about 403b plans. What's the difference between those and 401ks?
403b plans, also known as tax-sheltered annuities, are a lot like 401ks in how they work, but they're specifically for employees of nonprofits like public schools, churches, hospitals. The rules about employee and employer contributions are generally the same as for 401k plans.
So nonprofits often use 403bs. What about SEP plans?
Simplified employee pension, or SEP plans, are designed to be easy to manage, especially for small businesses. Mm. In a SEP plan, the employer puts money directly into traditional IRA accounts set up for each employee. There's less paperwork compared to other qualified plans, and the employer contribution limits can be quite a bit higher than for regular IRAs. A big plus for employees is that they're always 100% vested in all employer contributions.
Okay, and lastly, we have simple plans. What's the main idea behind those?
Simple plans, which stand for Savings Incentive Match Plans for Employees, are another option aimed at small employers, specifically those with 100 or fewer employees who don't offer another retirement plan. A simple plan can be either an IRA or a 401k. They let employees defer some of their salary, and employers have to either match a certain percentage of those contributions or make a non-elective contribution. The employee contribution limits are usually lower than for regular 401ks and 403bs. Like SEP plans, employees are immediately 100% vested in all employer contributions. One thing to watch out for is that simple plans have a higher penalty for early withdrawals during the first 2 years. It's 25% instead of the usual 10%.
That's a really useful breakdown of the different employer-sponsored plans.
Yeah.
We touched on ERISA earlier. Can you tell us a little more about its overall purpose?
ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, was created mainly to protect the interests of participants and beneficiaries in all sorts of employee benefit plans. That includes not just retirement plans, but also things like group health insurance.
Okay, and we talked about fiduciary responsibility. What are the core ideas behind that under ERISA?
ERISA sets really strict standards for anyone who has power over the management or assets of an employee benefit plan. These folks, called fiduciaries, are legally bound to act in the best financial interests of the plan participants and their beneficiaries. They have to manage the plan wisely, avoid conflicts of interest, and follow the plan documents. There are big legal and financial penalties for anyone who doesn't follow these rules.
So it's all about making sure those in charge are acting responsibly and for the benefit of the employees. What about the reporting and disclosure requirements under ERISA?
ERISA demands a lot of transparency. Employers have to provide a ton of information about their benefit plans to participants, beneficiaries, the Department of Labor, and the IRS. This includes documents like the summary plan description, which explains the plan in plain language summaries of any major changes made to the plan, an annual report with the plan's financial status and how it's doing, a summary annual report for participants, and even a final report if the plan ends.
Wow. So lots of ways to keep everyone informed and hold people accountable. Now, the document also briefly mentions non-qualified plans. What are those all about?
Non-qualified plans are retirement plans that employers can offer to a specific group of employees, often top executives. Unlike qualified plans, they don't get the same favorable tax treatment under ERISA, and they don't have to follow the same strict rules about participation and non-discrimination. This gives employers more leeway in how they design these plans. Common examples are bonus plans and deferred compensation deals.
So it's a way for companies to offer customized retirement benefits to certain employees outside of the standard qualified plan system.
Exactly.
We've covered a lot of ground today, really digging deep into both individual retirement accounts and employer-sponsored qualified plans.
We have. And as this material emphasizes, planning for retirement is absolutely critical.
It is.
And as you've heard, there's a whole spectrum of options available, each with its own rules, pros and cons.
Yeah. So for you, our listener, we hope this deep dive has made the world of retirement savings a lot clearer. With a better grasp of IRAs and the various employer-sponsored plans out there, now's a good time to think about which type or maybe combination might work best for your own situation and goals.
This overview is a solid starting point for your next steps. We encourage you to explore the specific types of plans that seem most relevant to you, or to talk with a qualified financial advisor who can give you personalized guidance and help you navigate the details so you can make smart choices about your future.
And on that note, remember that stat we started with, over half of Americans might not be able to keep up their living standard in retirement. So here's a question for you. What's one concrete step you'll take this week to better understand your retirement savings options or to take some action towards a more secure future? That's something to really think about.
Definitely food for thought.
All right, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, everyone.
We'll see you next time for another deep dive.
See you later.